Today I have an exceptional pleasure in speaking to someone who really is legendary in the Lancaster community, whose impact on healthcare in this community is probably unrivaled. And I'm speaking, of course, about Nick Cervanos, who's been the founder and the director of our esteemed and nationally recognized family practice residency since its very beginning in 1969 until his recent retirement. Nick, welcome.
Thank you, Larry. It's good to be here.
I've been looking forward to this for some time because your story is such an interesting one, and I think the interesting aspect of it begins really quite at the beginning. So I wonder if you would just start by telling us a little bit about your upbringing and the early years before you went into medicine.
Well, Larry, I grew up in Reading, and the block that I lived on consisted of mostly Greek immigrant families. That had a big impact on my formative years because the Greek families that lived on that block were either relatives or close friends of my own family. And therefore, they became my own extended family. And from a medical point of view, we had a family physician who had his office around the block from where we lived. His name was Dr. Levan. I'll never forget him because he always seemed to be around somewhere in the neighborhood visiting families, or sometimes we would be visiting him, of course.
Now, he was Greek?
No, but he was our family doctor because he was the guy right around the block from where we lived.
Now, how did he communicate with the...
Most of the males in the neighborhood could speak English. And so when we would go to the doctor, that was usually with our fathers, but sometimes I would go, my mother needed to go to the doctor, she took one of her boys with her.
How big a family did you?
We were a family of four, but my sister died before any of us were born. And she played a very important role in our family. Even though I never knew Julia, she was so important to us because her life and her illness and her death had such an impact on our family. It was sad for sure, and I heard about her many, many times from my parents, but I always wished I had gotten to know her because she was obviously so special to us in our family.
How old was she? When
3 years old. Actually, she died of a medulloblastoma, believe it or not. And I learned about my sister, by the way, when I was in medical school, because that's where she died. She died on the operating room table. And Dr. Grant, a well-known neurosurgeon at the University of Pennsylvania at the time, was the one who operated on her, and she died on the table. Mm-hmm. And people will say that my mother was a much, much different person after my sister died.
Now, how did you get from that background to medical school?
I must admit, I never considered seriously becoming a physician. I thought that was a bit of an unrealistic goal, mostly for financial reasons. But on the other hand, there were family physicians and physicians in our family that I heard about and never met them. I had an uncle, by the way, by the name of Hippocrates. Not only is Hippocrates a famous name in medicine, but it turns out that our family actually came from the island of Kos, which was the famous island of Hippocrates.
And of course, is that a common Greek name?
Not common, but not uncommon. The others were cousins of my dad's, and I heard about them many, many times.
Well, but you didn't tell me really how you managed to get to medical school.
Well, I went to Albright College, which is in Reading. I had a generous scholarship, so I didn't have any financial problems getting through college. And I was working, too, at the same time, working at Joseph's clothing store. I had a classmate of mine. His name is Phil Goldfeder. And Phil was a pre-med student. And he kept telling me, you ought to be a doctor, Nick. You just need to be a doctor. And I must admit, I start thinking about it seriously. And I start talking about it among some of my relatives. And they told me I should go talk to Gus Yatrin. Gus Yatrin, at the time, was a Greek-American state senator. And when I went to visit him, he says, Nick, you get into medical school either at Penn, Pitt, or Temple, and I'll get you a senatorial scholarship, and you won't have to worry about tuition. So I worked even harder than I was working, and I managed to get into all three of them. And so I ended up at Penn. And the medical school at Penn was just an incredibly good experience for me. I enjoyed it immensely. I enjoyed being with the kind of people that I was associated with, classmates, the faculty, and so forth. It was a good time to be in medical school. 58 to 62 was a period of big change that was about to take place in medical education. And I felt like I was in the middle of all of that. And some of those discussions that were taking place had to do with what was viewed as a crisis in the healthcare delivery system. That back in those days, we were talking about a serious doctor shortage. We weren't producing enough doctors. In fact, if you included the 82 medical allopathic schools and the 7 osteopathic schools that we had at the time, they were producing less than 8,000 graduates. There was a need for not only general practitioners, but specialists as well.
Yeah, and let me interrupt for a moment to say, you say 82 medical schools, now we have 125.
That is correct. Well, actually, we have a few more now. They just added some more.
Here you are graduating from medical school. What did you do next?
Well, I always wanted to be a general practitioner, and I guess that has something to do with those comments I made earlier about my upbringing. But I also was always inclined to believe that I wanted to be a physician, that I had a personal relationship with a patient over a patient's lifetime. And I knew what general practitioners did. They took care of people when they were sick. They provided acute care medicine. But they also were very committed to the whole idea of comprehensive health care. And that involves, obviously, preventing disease when that's possible, and, of course, getting involved with people with their health maintenance issues and so forth. And that whole idea intrigued me. And then to be able to do that in the context of the family had a special appeal to me.
So what did you do?
So after medical school, I came to Lancaster to do my internship because Diana and I decided this is where we want to practice. This is her hometown.
Yeah, she is from Lancaster.
Yes, and we have lots of relatives here in Lancaster on her side and as well as on my side. And we were attracted to the Greek American community. We were very much involved with our church at the time. And all of that was attractive. So that's what we were going to do. And not only that, Dr. Frankos offered the opportunity for me to join him in practice. While I was doing my internship, though, I really did feel I needed some more education, graduate medical education, and I wanted to do another year. And I was going to do a general practice residency, but I was not particularly attracted to them. I didn't like the one that we had here necessarily, but I looked at others, and they were nothing much more than another year of internship. Basically, that's what they were.
That's basically what general practice training was in those days.
In those days, that's what it was.
Many people went into practice after just 1 year post medical school.
That is correct. That is correct. And in fact, most of my peers, that's what they did. So, first of all, I got accepted to do the 1 year in Philadelphia that I was going to do back in my affiliated university hospital, which was the VA. I thought I'd get a good general medicine background. Then I would come back and join up with Charlie. Then I got drafted, and Dr. Close told me when I got out of the Army, the position would be ready for me when I got out. With that in mind, after I got my draft notice, I talked to my peers, because I had one, Gene DeMagna was also one of my intern friends, and he got the draft notice too, and we decided we were going to go down to Washington to the assignment branch and see if we couldn't convince them to send us to where we wanted to go. And I wanted to go to Greece. Well, it turned out they had one U.S. Army Medical Corps position there, and it's a long story, but a fascinating one. But it's fascinating enough just to tell you that I got it, and so Diane and I spent almost the next 3 years in Greece. And while I was there, kept on getting these messages about perhaps we're going to have a new specialty. And in response to these issues of crisis in healthcare delivery, access issues, and that kind of thing. So Dean Gorin told me, why don't you get in touch with Dr. Alpert up at Harvard, because he's the new director of the Family Health Care Program, and he is now recruiting general practitioners for their fellowship program. And that program was designed to produce future leaders and academicians for the new specialty of family medicine that was about to become a reality. And he invited me to come for an interview when I got out of the Army. The good story is that I got accepted into that program, but we both agreed that I would finish up doing what I intended to do, and that is do that 1 year in Philadelphia and then come up. So then I went to Boston. And while I was in Boston, I was pretty much convinced that I wanted to pursue an academic career. And I was given the opportunity in Lancaster. I looked into some other situations, but obviously the opportunity in Lancaster had a lot of appeal, not only because it's coming back to Lancaster, but just the excitement of being able to develop a whole new department and being given the opportunity to develop one of these new residency programs in family medicine. Now, you have to remember, in July of 1969, when I came, that was only 4 months after the specialty was formally established. So what the policymakers did back in at the AMA, they created 15 pilot programs so that we had some head start in this whole field of family medicine. One of them was my own program back in Boston. And another one was right across the river at York Hospital, because Bob Evans, who was their DME, was a very visionary kind of guy and got on the bandwagon right away. And I think that also influenced John Espenshade to do the same here in Lancaster.
Now, John was our director.
He was our director of medical education, and he's the one that called me.
Right. And I will say, for the sake of our audience, because John is retired, that John Espenshade, by training, was a cardiologist.
Yes.
And had been to Guy's Hospital in London and was a very important part of the cardiology scene here for many years. Yeah. But obviously he's not practicing now, so I only wanted to mention that.
Yes. And of course, one of the things that Paul asked me to do when I put my hat in the ring for the
this
position,
is Paul Waddell.
Paul Waddell. Yeah, what he asked me to do was to send him a vision statement and what my goals and objectives might be. And that really gave me an opportunity. Being back in Boston and thinking about what I might want to do in Lancaster and what Boston was really doing with the Family Health Care Program gave me some really creative ideas in terms of how we can best deal with some of the hardcore healthcare delivery issues, particularly relating to the care of the medically indigent. That family health care program was doing just that, dealing especially with some of the more difficult psychosocial issues affecting poor people and so forth. And I knew from my experience in Lancaster, having done my internship, that we had our handful of those kinds of issues. So I had an idea that with the new family health, the new outpatient clinic that we were going to have, which I chose to call a service in family health care, which is a takeoff from our program up in Boston, that what we would do is make this a model in the care of low-income people. I had this notion that might even serve as our model family practice unit, which the RRC, the Residency Review Committee for Family Practice, said we had to have. But the big stumbling block was it had to have a wide socioeconomic mix of patients. And that wasn't too well received by the medical staff. That was back in 1969. We were very much against hospitals getting into the so-called private practice of medicine. After all, medicine was run by physicians, and the physicians wanted to maintain that kind of control, so to speak.
So what you're saying is that the medical staff here, the private practitioners in the community, did not want employed faculty in the family practice residency to be competing
right
with them.
With fee-for-service patients, with the so-called private patients.
Something like LGMG, which we take for granted now, with the hospital employing well over 125 physicians now.
Absolutely.
It increases almost daily. That would be taken for granted now.
Yeah, I know.
But
so
you
what
had
they did,
some, you yeah. had some really serious battles.
We did. I remember one physician told me, he says, "Nick, if I were you, I would give up this nonsense and just set up practice. You're going to get creamed. You're just going to get creamed. this isn't going to work here in Lancaster.
Okay, so you developed a workaround.
Yes, we did. And one of our primary goals right from the very beginning, and I told Paul that this was necessary, was to hire a director of our family practice center, because I needed somebody with practice experience and somebody who would be able to provide the kind of supervision that I thought our residents need, in addition to what I could provide, of course, but it wasn't going to be able to be a one-man show. So he understood that, and I told him who I had in mind, and he was really excited about me approaching Henry Wentz, because he was so highly respected by the medical staff, and I personally considered him one of my role models when I was an intern back in 1962-63, and considered him clearly one of the best family doctors in Lancaster County. And he also had the academic inclinations. And so I thought he'd be a perfect fit. And I was just hoping he wouldn't say no. And when we approached Henry, he definitely was interested. But it had to be only with the proviso that we could get him some help. Well, Ivan Lehman was a general practice resident at the time when I started in 1969. And Ivan was approached, and thank God he was interested in joining up with Henry. And that made it possible for Henry to give us half of his time. And he stayed with us for almost 3 years. And of course, in the meantime, we were able to hire additional faculty, Dr. John Randall, Dr. Herb Tindall. And we even had the opportunity to bring Myron Rubin on board, who was a outstanding internist and outstanding teacher that we had in our house staff program. And when Myron came on board and ran our family practice inpatient service, that just gave us so much credibility and got us off to such a great start.
Well, as an aside about Mike Rubin, as we called him, in the current issue of the Journal, I have an interview with Bill McCann about the development of the cardiology program. Yeah. And in that recording, I mention an anecdote about Mike Rubin that reinforces what you're saying about the character of the man. Because when we started the heart surgery program, our 64th patient died. Not bad. We had done 63 cases. The patient died of coronary spasm, which nowadays would have been prevented by a calcium channel blocker, which we didn't have in those days. Mm-hmm. But Mike, who had referred the patient to us, came up to me afterwards, and instead of complaining or criticizing, said, "Larry, I want to apologize to you for referring the first patient who didn't do well."
How about that?
As if it were his fault. So, just an aside to reinforce what you're saying about the kind of an impact that he made on people.
Yep.
Now, I'd like to direct your comments towards the development of the family practice model, which was a problem that you had to resolve, and you worked around it by developing the Quarryville program.
Yes. As a matter of fact, one of the first thing Henry Wentz did for us came up with this idea that why don't we establish our family practice center, our model family practice unit, in the southern end of the county, which was, in fact, probably the most underserved area of Lancaster County at the time. There were only about 5 physicians taking care of about 20,000 people that lived in a 300-square-mile area of southern Lancaster County. And one of them was Dr. Charles Baer. Charlie was in his mid-60s already. He was chairman of our Department of General Practice. He was one of the advocates for the creation of the new Department of Family and Community Medicine and the residency program, and thankfully a strong supporter of Henry's idea. Obviously, he knew the problem of the southern end of the county and welcomed the notion of having a family practice center in Quarryville.
So that would allow you to have a socioeconomically broadly based program.
Absolutely.
That was not a threat to the staff at the central city hospital.
Right, because we were 16 miles away, 35 minutes away. It was sort of out of the way, and it really didn't seem to be as critical an issue. Plus, many of the people who recognized the problem that the Charlie Bears of Lancaster County were having were very sympathetic, and they could see that this would be a very positive development.
Win-win.
A win-win, absolutely. Yeah.
So you were able to establish that there. It obviously has been successful ever since. And you only, though, as I understand it, had to convince the Residency Review Committee that it wasn't too far away.
That's right. They had to make a compromise themselves.
But they bought that argument.
They waived the requirement because we were going to be the only family practice residency program at that time that was going to have a rural-based family practice center. Now, it also created another interesting challenge, if you will, and that is, how do we integrate the Family Health Service into the residency program? And we came up with the idea that we would have a community medicine curriculum and sell the community medicine curriculum to the RRC. And the heart of that curriculum would be the Family Health Service. We were going to demonstrate how we could better serve medically indigent people through a residency program and also emphasize the care of people in our practice with maternity and child health issues. And that was going to be a major component of the Family Health Service. And that was also desirable because it was very not easy for a family practice center by itself, like the one that we were going to have in Quarryville, to generate enough OB patients to satisfy the requirements that our residents had in terms of adequate volume. So this satisfied two needs in terms of an educational need plus a service requirement need, because my vision is from the very beginning was to try to do something to better serve our city population with the heavy concentration of low-income and medically indigent people. And of course, with the opportunities that were given to us by the federal government through medical assistance and Medicare, the actual financial aspects of this whole endeavor were to a large extent attenuated, because now we had actually some revenue to help pay for the added requirements that we put on the department, because we were going to add faculty, not only to supervise the residents, but also to help care for the patients. So we gradually took out the volunteer system that was in place over a 2 or 3 year period. We were able to do away with volunteers.
By developing the clinic here in the city, which is basically an indigent clinic.
And it no longer is quite that way. It's still heavily concentrated to indigent, but with the changes, of course, that have taken place in recent years, we were able to integrate other kinds of patients into the practice as well. But it's still that's still the primary focus, to take care of the low-income people.
But of course, by now, everybody's so busy that nobody is worrying about
the few patients
that the faculty.
Plus, we created the LGMG system.
Summarize for me, if you will, the record of the residency since 1969, when you started, in terms of the people you've produced, what they've been doing, the impact on the practice in this community, and I suspect you know most of those numbers.
Under my tenure, we graduated about 330 graduates. We're approaching the 400 figure as of now.
You retired in
July 2002. So when I retired, Larry, I was the longest tenured program director in America. I served as its director for 33 straight years. These 330 graduates are some of the very finest family physicians in America. Obviously biased, but I feel that way. And they really are an especially attractive group of doctors. And at least a third of them are practice here in Lancaster County. But in addition to that, about 20% of our graduates have ended up in part-time or full-time academic positions. And I would say no less than 5% of our graduates have been in full-time director positions of residency programs. We have had several chairs of family medicine who are graduates of our program. And they are extraordinary people. 6 of our graduates have been singled out by their state academies all over the United States as Family Physicians of the Year. That is quite an accomplishment. And of those who are full-time, about another half of those ended up in directorships, either director of a residency program or chairs of departments of family medicine.
Now, in addition, you had an imperative in your program that people should try to do some kind of research, should try to publish in peer-reviewed journals.
Yes. One of the things we did right from the very beginning is we established a requirement that every resident in the program would publish or write a paper, a clinical paper, either in their second or third year. This could be based on some of the research that they might have been doing, because that too was being encouraged right from the very beginning. But they had to write a paper, whether they were doing research or not, a clinical paper, present that to their peers in the faculty, and we encouraged them to publish those papers. And actually, to this date, we have among the most resident published papers in the United States, among all residency programs in the United States. Now, along those lines, let me tell you one thing else that we did. Remember, 1969 was it wasn't really the end of the 60s. You might even say it was the middle of the 60s. There was so much upheaval in America at that time. America was struggling. America was looking for leaders. And I thought, this residency program has a bunch of leaders. We are attracting leaders. That's the kind of resident we want. And we're going to ask them to assume leadership roles while they're in the residency program. So what did we do? We said, by the time you're a second year resident, you must become involved in some kind of community service project, whether it's dealing with the addictive disease problem, or whether it's teenage pregnancy, or whether it's tobacco cessation. You name it. You could even do something with your synagogue or with your church. But we want you to be involved in some project that will demonstrate that you're taking charge of an issue or problem that affects the welfare of this community. And I have to tell you, the payoff was this. We've had residents every year nominated for the American Academy of Family Physicians Leadership Award. They used to give out 10. They now give out 20. And we've had more recipients for one of those awards than any other residency program in the United States.
Well, you know, all of these things that we've talked about reflect your own commitment to service to the patient and service to the community. And it's no surprise that this residency has been and remains a real standout, even among all of the residencies in this country.
And it still is. I have to tell you, yesterday, Dr. Radcliffe was so excited, and I could feel his excitement because we filled once again. And not only did we filled with outstanding people once again. Really, really good people.
Well, I said in the introduction that you have actually had more impact on healthcare in this community than any other single person, and I have no doubt about that. And after listening to you, I should think that our entire audience understands why I said that.
Thank you.
So thank you very much for coming.
Thank you, Larry. Thank you. Thank you.